Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming to the symposium. What I'll do today is start off talking a little bit about STD prevention funding, and then I'll talk about heterogeneity. And what we mean by that is differences in STD rates by geographic and demographic and other factors. Then I'll talk a little bit about concentration of sexual behaviors, and what we mean by that is how a few people account for most of the risky sex. And then because of heterogeneity and concentration of sexual behaviors, we know that targeting and prioritization of interventions can help us maximize our return on investment. And then I'll conclude with a couple of examples of the importance of evaluation. So the CDC prevention budget is about $10.5 billion. Of that, about $0.7 billion is for HIV, about $0.2 billion is for STDs. I know we hear millions, billions, trillions a lot. Sometimes it's hard to put that in context. So I've shown here the funding per capita. So we get about 50 cents a person, the CDC does, for STD prevention. So to put that in perspective, you can look at consumption, American spending on other goods like bottled water, candy, and lotteries. So we spend, compared to the 50 cents we're spending for STD prevention, we're spending about $50 per person on bottled water, $28 on candy, and $108 on lottery tickets, just to show the perspective of that. And that's the federal picture. We know that things are looking even, I guess, more grim when we look about state and local funding. We know there's been a lot of cuts and things are getting a lot tougher there. And I came across this preparing for a financial setback. And this is something Northwest Airlines gave out. They laid off a lot of employees a few years ago, and they thought it would be nice if they gave the employees a list of 101 ways to save money now that they were unemployed. Number one was to set your thermostat to 64 and turn it down to 60 at night. Said take a date for a walk in the woods. So you don't have to worry that your date will think you're a serial killer. She'll think you're a cheap serial killer. Number 21, make your own baby food. And this will help you on your next job interview, is to hand wash your suit instead of dry cleaning. And finally, my favorite was, don't be shy about pulling something you like out of the trash. So hopefully the suggestions we give today will be better than the Northwest Airlines tips. So differences in STD rates by geography and demography, starting with geographical differences in STD rates. I'm sure many of you have seen these slides before. We know that primary and secondary syphilis is highly concentrated. There's a lot of counties that don't have any syphilis at all. Gonorrhea is concentrated, but not quite to the same degree as syphilis. And then chlamydia is a bit more widespread. Another way to look at this is the percent of STD cases that in the U.S. that are accounted for by the top 25, 50, and 100 counties. So, for example, for syphilis shown in blue, the top 25 counties account for almost half of syphilis, the top 50 counties account for almost two-thirds of the syphilis, and the top 100 counties account for about 75%. And then gonorrhea, and then followed by chlamydia in terms of the most concentrated. Now, that doesn't take into account the population of these counties. So another way to look at this is to group the counties by STD rate and then look at the top 5% of the population and the top 20% of the population. When doing that, the top 5% of the population accounts for about 14% of the chlamydia cases, 26% of the syphilis cases. And the top 20% population accounts for almost 40% of chlamydia and 63% of syphilis, with gonorrhea somewhere in between. The Gini coefficient has been proposed as a way to measure this dispersion across geographic areas. The Gini coefficient can range from 0, which is perfect equality, where everybody has the same STD rate, to 1, which is perfect inequality, where one county has all the STDs. And gonorrhea and syphilis consistently have a higher Gini coefficient than chlamydia, and gonorrhea and syphilis, therefore, just better suited for geographically targeted interventions than chlamydia. Everybody knows about the differences in race and ethnicity. You'll see a lot of graphs about, you know, group X has 20 times the rate of group Y, so I'm not going to even show those because I'm sure everybody's well-versed in that. The differences in STD rates by age and sex. We know we find most of the chlamydia in young women. That's who we screen. Gonorrhea also concentrated among the young. And even PNS syphilis, which is more evenly distributed across the age groups, still the highest rates are among those 20 to 29. Now I'll talk briefly about concentration of sexual behaviors. This is work that Jamie Leiter led, and one of the findings from the survey data was that the 5% of the population with the highest number of vaginal sex acts accounted for more sex acts than the bottom 50% of the population with the lowest number of sex acts. So what do we mean by that? Here's an example. Let's say we have 100 people. The five most active people will have a combined 135 sex acts in the past month, whereas the 50 least active people will have 45 sex acts. So you see most of those, the top 5% are really counting for a lot. Same goes with lifetime sex partnerships. The 5% of the population with the highest number of lifetime sex partners has more partnerships than the bottom 50% of the population with the lowest number of sex partners. So another example, suppose we have 100 people. The five most active people will have 165 lifetime sex partners combined, whereas the 50 least active people will have 70 lifetime partners combined. This is from a model by Miriam Krishmar, which was based on survey data, and it shows the distribution of the number of partners, which is consistent with the slide I just showed. And down here, these people with 5 to 9 and up to 20 more partners, this pretty much is the core, what we call the core. And it dawned on me, we really don't have a name for these people up here who aren't having any sex, so I thought we can call them the Gettysburg Address Group because their last four scores were 7 years ago. So now, because we know STDs are concentrated in certain groups in certain areas and risky sexual behaviors are concentrated among certain people, we can target and prioritize and maximize our return on investment. So targeting by geography, let's say this is a simple model that I put together. Suppose we had about $50 million to spend at the national level, and we were going to give this money out to the states and focus on gonorrhea. Suppose we decided to give every state an equal amount of money, we'd see a decline in gonorrhea over time. This isn't the best way to do it, though. Some states have a lot of people, some states don't. So it would make more sense to at least base the funding decision somewhat on population. So if we gave everybody the same per capita funding, the decline in gonorrhea would be greater, shown by the green line. And then as Gail was talking about today, with the CSPS funding, if we base some of it on burden so that we can target where the disease is, we would see even more of a decline in gonorrhea over time. Charlie Ravens presented a real-world example about targeting gonorrhea services, and he kindly allowed me to share a couple of his slides. I won't go into too many details, but they selected these six cities for targeted intervention, and shown by the first highlighted bar, the criteria was to choose cities that had a high percentage of cases occurring among African Americans, and then as shown by the final highlighted bar, they wanted to choose cities where maybe six zip codes accounted for most of those gonorrhea cases. So that's why they chose these six cities. And the intervention took place in 2009, and the percentage change was quite dramatic. Overall, for the six cities, it was over a 50% decline from 2007 to 2010. And here is Illinois, where the intervention was. And notice that 2010, after the intervention, Illinois is a lighter shade, showing lower gonorrhea rates among African Americans. Was that attributable to the intervention? We don't know, but I can show you that the year before the intervention, that same did not hold. They had the same rates as African Americans in the neighboring states. So that's some evidence that targeted effort had a big effect. This is just an example from 1999, just to show that you can go back in time and see that people have been talking about geographically targeted interventions for a long time. And in this example, from two New York counties, the one with the geographically targeted intervention had a 61% decline in gonorrhea over time, whereas the non-targeted intervention only had a 50% decline over time, and that difference was significant. And this slide shows the annual percentage change in early syphilis rates in states that were and were not initially targeted for syphilis elimination. The 0% line, anything above that is an increase. Anything below that is good, showing a decrease. I show this for two reasons. First, to show that the targeted efforts of syphilis elimination, I think that, you can see that there's a difference between the targeted and non-targeted states. But also, I think syphilis elimination gets a bad rap when, in fact, in the areas that were targeted, there were decreases. I think syphilis elimination, we should compare syphilis rates to what they would have been in the absence of the elimination effort rather than looking at just before and after. So targeting by age. This slide shows the average cost per quality-adjusted life year gained by female chlamydia screening in the U.K. And as you can see, as the cutoff age of chlamydia screening increases, the cost per quality gained increases as well. As everybody knows, the older and older you screen, the less cost-effective it is. And this is a study that Kyle Bernstein published last year. And what's interesting is showing the potential overscreening of females 26 and over. And in this group, because of this, in the differences in positivity in the two groups, the cost per case detected was under $2,000 in the younger group and almost $5,000 in the older group. So targeting by risk group. This is an example. Again, I wanted to choose an older one. This was from 1996 from James Kahn. And what he did was to show the estimated number of HIV infections averted with $1 million in additional prevention funding. And over a five-year period, by targeting the right group, the high-risk group, you could avert 123 cases compared to two if your money was spent on the lowest-risk group. And over a 20-year scenario, these differences were even more pronounced. So prioritization of interventions. I thought this was a neat example from a few years ago that Cohen and colleagues published in their resource allocation model. And they were talking about the 2004 money that CDC allocated for HIV prevention, about $400 million. And what they said in their model was, based on what the CDC says to do with this money, we can avert 7,000 cases a year. But if you can, you know, do what our model says to do, we could avert 20,000 cases. So the, you know, the CDC, I think, didn't take kindly to this. And they said, you know, they responded, you know, the Cohen paper has some incompleteness and inaccuracies. And they said the choice and calculation in the author's model created an incomplete evaluation of the CDC's prevention approach. So Cohen wrote, I thought, a clever response. And they said the CDC should allocate its prevention funds in a rational way that maximizes preventive benefit. And I thought this was the best part. They say if they do not agree with the details of our cost allocation model, then they should develop and use their own model. So their point was, you know, even if you don't like ours, you know, come up with your own. You know, just don't just make up an allocation to give. And now there is much more modeling going on at the CDC. And now a couple of examples of the importance of evaluation. This was from Betty Apt, a former colleague in our branch. And she did an evaluation of a syphilis screening program. And the way the area was evaluating this was based on the number of people tested. And they tested over 1,500 people, so they thought it was a big success. But when Betty asked them how many cases they found, they went back and checked their records and found, you know, it was zero. So that, in response to that, they have changed the way they evaluate and they changed the way they do their outreach. This next example was from a mobile medical clinic for syphilis screening. The cost of the mobile outreach was $70,000 over the course of the year, and they tested 926 people for syphilis, and they detected five syphilis cases. So the cost per case detected was $14,000. And you can get a new car for under that. So it would have been cheaper to buy those five people a new car to come to get to get treated for syphilis than it was to go out there doing the screening. And that reminded me the difference between what you pay for and what you get. It happens in the business world too. And this example was from that movie Raise the Titanic. I don't know if anybody here remembers that. But in today's dollars, it cost about $100 million to make it. And it only brought in $20 million, so that was a big flop for the time. But what I really liked about it was how the film producer took this great loss in stride and said it would have been cheaper to lower the Atlantic. So in summary, we know STD rates differ by geography and by demographic factors. And because of this, targeted STD prevention efforts can have a greater impact on STDs, and they can be more cost-effective. And in today's world, being more cost-effective is very important. And evaluation is critical to make sure we are spending the money at the right places and in the right ways. And finally, don't be shy about pulling something you like out of the trash. I want to thank those who helped contribute to this, and thank you.